Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Okay, so today we're diving into something, well, pretty intense. We're looking at this strange crossroads where really deep personal ritual born from grief actually meets the kind of cold, hard logic of systemic control. It sounds unlikely, I know, but we have these two sets of source notes. One is this analytical framework, the Inspector Story Podcast Index. You know, it uses figures like Buzz Lightyear or Aladdin to unpack real world ideas about deletion systems, forbidden tech, things like that.
And the other source, which is really the heart of today's deep dive, is this detailed remembrance called the Gingerbread Ashes. It's an account from central Pennsylvania starting back in 1891. And it's a truly harrowing story about family tragedy and how a sister's grief spiraled into this consuming piece of domestic folklore.
So our mission today is to see how these connect. We're going to follow the timeline of the Gingerbread Ashes, this devastating story, step by step.
Right. And we'll use the archetypes from the Inspector Index, almost like analytical tools, to try and understand how that personal tragedy transformed. How does individual grief sometimes mirror these, well, these larger, colder systems of control and erasure?
We're hunting for those moments, those connections, where you see the intimate struggle for memory reflecting something much bigger. It's about the alchemy of ash, but also archetypes. Let's start at the beginning, with the tragedy itself. Okay, so picture this. Central Pennsylvania, 1891. We need to really set the scene. The source describes this house, Elsie's home, as usually smelling of just two things: smoke from the hearth and sugar from baking. You know, the smell of safety, of home.
But then an early frost hits, and the source emphasizes this isn't just about the weather getting cold. It's about the failure of the core domestic system. That frost is like an external breach that highlights just how fragile the warmth inside really was.
And that fragility becomes devastatingly real.
It does. The tragedy is stark. Elsie's little brother, he just didn't wake up one morning. The account uses this chillingly simple phrase. His body felt light as bread dough.
Oh, that's visceral.
It is. And the cause. It's the ultimate system failure for that household. The stove fire, the very heart of their warmth, their life support, really. It had gone out during the night.
That detail, light as bread dough, it just captures the fragility, doesn't it? The life literally gone out of him, exposed by that cold. It's a profound failure, like you said, of the domestic system, but it's also just a betrayal by the world, right?
Absolutely. And that sense of systemic breakdown, that sudden vulnerability, it clicks immediately with one of the index archetypes.
Which one are you thinking of?
The Disney World controlled zone. That archetype is all about systems where safety and control feel absolute, omnipresent, but they're actually reliant on these hidden, often fragile protocols.
Like the fire staying lit.
Exactly. When the fire died, the protocol failed. The illusion of the warm, safe home just shattered instantly. And what's revealed underneath is this deadly reality, the vulnerability that was always there, just hidden.
So the immediate aftermath, the focus shifts to the mother. The source describes her just sitting there by the cold stove until dawn, almost a silhouette against the metal, just this immense, silent grief. She's absorbing the failure of the heart, the center of her home.
And when she finally acts, when she strikes a match, it's not about getting warm. It's something else entirely. It's described as this consuming, almost primal grief ritual.
That you do.
The details are quite specific. She starts feeding the flames anything she can find, chairs, rags, even the boy's blanket. It's like she's trying to force the fire back to life, or maybe just burn away the memory of the cold, the failure.
A desperate attempt to regain control, maybe.
Perhaps. But then, when there's nothing left to burn, the notes confirm this next step. It's an agonizing act of deliberate erasure. She lifted him into the flames.
Shattering. An act born of pure agony.
Absolutely. But here's the crucial point, the detail that really fuels the entire legend that follows. The source makes a point of saying that while the fire consumed the physical body, the smell stayed. An intense, specific smell lingered.
Okay, wait. Let's pause there. The smell stayed. She attempted total erasure, this fiery purification, but it didn't work.
Not entirely.
Yeah.
And that failure, that transition from physical destruction to this lingering sensory evidence, is critical. It speaks directly to how erasure often functions in these systems.
How so?
It mirrors the mechanism we see with the Klaus Richter, Dory Schatten archetype in the Index. Richter is the figure who systems tried to delete entirely from history, like every record wiped.
Yeah, the ghost soldier.
Exactly. But the very act of trying to erase him, that intense effort, leaves its own trace, a data echo. The erasure itself becomes the proof that something significant was there. It's the same principle here. The fire consumed the physical, but that lingering smell. It became the undeniable evidence of the tragedy of the life lost. The memory wasn't destroyed. It was transformed into this volatile sensory data that just wouldn't go away.
But a smell that's so intangible, how do you hold on to that? How does it become something solid? This leads us to Elsie, the sister, doesn't it?
It does. She's the one who takes the next crucial step. She interacts with the immediate residue of that fire, that ritual.
What did she do?
She saved a handful of the ashes. The description is simple. Soft, gray, and still warm. It's the physical embodiment of that moment, of the grief and the fire and the failed erasure.
A handful of warm ash.
That small object, that handful of ash, becomes the anchor. It's the seed from which the entire legend grows. It's the physical artifact.
So from the Index perspective, what does an artifact like that represent? An object born from trauma surviving the moment.
It's incredibly significant. This ash, it's an artifact that now carries the weight of that moment, imbued with the mother's desperate ritual, the lost life, the lingering smell. It's destined to outlive the immediate event. This fits perfectly with the callback for Buzz Lightyear, Russell Kearney.
How does Buzz Lightyear fit in here?
In the Kearney analysis, the point is that artifacts often outlive their creator's original intent. They take on a life of their own, carrying the devotion, the trauma, the intention of the moment they were created or imbued with meaning. Elsie, by keeping these ashes, she's not just holding on to a physical remnant. She's unconsciously taking on the burden of that memory, that devotion. The trauma is now contained, portable, in this small handful of ash.
Okay, so the trauma is contained, but it's still volatile, right? Just in a different form. Where does she take it next?
She takes it into the heart of domestic ritual.
Right. This moves us into the second stage, what the notes call the alchemy of grief. And the setting shifts dramatically, doesn't it? We're out of the immediate aftermath, the raw grief, and into the kitchen on Christmas Eve.
Exactly. A time loaded with tradition, baking, transformation, family. It's a perfect setting for this next step. Elsie takes that container of volatile memory, the ashes, and performs the key act of this grief alchemy.
She mixes the ashes into bread dough.
Yes. Directly into the dough. Think about that phrase, grief alchemy. It's like taking this chaotic, overwhelming emotion and forcing it into a structured process, a recipe, making it manageable, repeatable, almost scientific in its own way.
Turning grief into an ingredient.
Precisely. And she doesn't just mix it in. She shapes the dough into a small figure, a little man, and adds raisins for eyes.
Raisins for eyes. That detail is so specific, so haunting. It's about recognition, isn't it? Trying to give form, a recognizable face to the loss.
Absolutely. She's trying to make the intangible tangible, the loss, something she can see, interact with. And this act, this shaping of the grief-laden dough, it starts to function like a system training its user.
How do you mean? Like the recipe is training her?
In a way, yes. The figure itself, made from loss but designed for recognition, starts to train Elsie in a new system of devotion. This connects to the Monopoly, the collector, entry in the Index.
Monopoly. How does a board game relate?
The Monopoly archetype isn't just about the game. It's about how structured systems, games, rituals, bureaucracies, train participants in obedience. You have to learn the rules, follow the steps, invest your energy before you get any kind of reward or payoff, if you ever do.
Yeah.
Elsie is learning to interact with her grief through this very specific, repeatable ritual. The recipe demands obedience. The immediate reward isn't closure, it's just the structure itself.
And she follows the structure to the end. The source says she whispered her brother's name just before placing the figure near the fire, or maybe into it.
Near or into the oven, yes. The hearth, the stove, the very thing that failed them initially is now being repurposed. She's trying to use it as the stabilizing force for this new ritual. trying to reclaim that center of warmth and control.
Does it work? Does the ritual provide confirmation?
According to the sources, the sensory confirmation is immediate and overwhelming. As the figure baked, a scent filled the kitchen, described as sweet, sharp, and almost human.
Almost human. That's chilling.
And crucially, it's not just Elsie who experiences this. This is where the ritual solidifies, becomes shared. Her mother, the one who performed the initial fiery erasure, she reacts, she weeps, and says specifically, it smelled like him.
Wow. So the mother confirms it. The connection is made real, at least for them. It's not just Elsie's private act anymore.
Exactly. That shared recognition validates the entire ritual. The memory, carried in the ashes, transformed by the dough and the fire, is now tangible, perceptible, and shared. The oven, which represented failure, is now the successful crucible for this haunting. It reinforces that idea that domestic objects, the hearth, the oven, they become containers for memory, stabilizers for volatile grief, especially in folklore like this. The memory is now locked into a recipe, something repeatable.
But repeatable rituals, they can become obsessions, can't they? This feels like a dangerous path.
Extremely dangerous. And that leads us directly into the next phase.
Okay, so the ritual worked, in a sense. It provided a shared moment of recognition, a tangible connection. But it didn't end there. This moves us into the winters of whispering. It became a cycle.
Yes, the structure she created demanded repetition. The source notes state it clearly. Each winter, Elsie baked another. The ritual wasn't a one-off memorial. It became an annual obligation.
And time passes. The notes say, by the third year, the ritual wasn't just repeated. It had deepened somehow, cemented itself.
Right. And that repetition, that deepening commitment, starts to have a profound psychological effect. The ritual is no longer just something she does. It's something that shapes her time, her focus, maybe even her reality.
And this is where it shifts from remembrance to something interactive, isn't it? The source says the figures began to whisper back.
That's the critical turning point. The grief embodied in these figures stops being a passive object of devotion and becomes, in Elsie's perception, an active, responsive entity. This is where the personal ritual truly crosses over into active, living folklore, at least within her own mind.
That feedback loop, it sounds incredibly isolating. She's interacting with these figures, not the outside world.
Precisely. She's no longer just tending a memory. She's caught in a dialogue with a mechanism of her own making. And this dynamic, where the memory of the deceased is frozen in time by the ritual, while the life of the living person gets stuck, arrested by that same ritual, that's the core of the real Wendy Peter Pan callback in the index.
Explain that connection. How is Elsie like Wendy?
Wendy represents the person left behind, whose life gets defined by the memory of someone lost in Neverland, someone who never grows up. The record, the memory, is frozen. But Wendy's life also becomes arrested, trapped in that role of remembering Peter. Elsie is becoming trapped in this arrested time, dedicating her winters, her life, to maintaining this interaction with a memory fixed in childhood.
So, the source says, she spoke to them at night, lined up on the windowsill.
And they whispered back, cementing the myth and deepening her separation from everything else.
But it wasn't just voices she heard, right? There was physical evidence reinforcing the interaction.
Yes, another layer that makes it feel real, at least to her. The source mentions small, strange details found each morning. Crumbs on her pillow, but not just any crumbs, crumbs specifically shaped like tiny footprints.
Footprints on her pillow. That's incredibly disturbing. It's like physical proof of the haunting left behind by the very figures she baked.
Exactly. It's the residual evidence. The crumbs become the undeniable trace of this phantom presence, validating the interaction in a tangible way, the forensic proof generated by the ritual itself.
So the crumbs are the witness, proof that this forbidden interaction is actually happening.
That's a perfect way to put it. This fits the analysis of Luke Skywalker, Luan Saimong, from the Index. The core idea there is that the witness, often unexpected evidence, or a seemingly minor detail, becomes the weapon, the proof, the confirmation of the forbidden technology or the secret system.
So the figures themselves are the forbidden tech of grieving.
Right. And the crumbs are the residual evidence, the witness that confirms the tech works, but in a way that only Elsie can truly interpret, trapping her further inside this closed loop she's created.
It makes a terrifying kind of sense.
Now, stepping back for a moment, it's worth grounding this specific disturbing ritual in a slightly broader context. If we look at folklore, this idea of using the hearth or oven in grief rituals isn't unique to Elsie's story, this concept of grief alchemy.
You mentioned that earlier.
Right. The focused use of the hearth, the center of the home, for transformation in the face of death. It appears in various forms across cultures. Think about bread and ash folklore traditions, creating a specific ritual object, often baked, to contain, commemorate, or even appease the spirit of the deceased. It's a recognized pattern.
So baking as a way to process death has historical roots?
In a sense, yes. It's about using the predictable, controllable system of domestic work baking, tending the fire to impose some kind of order on the ultimate chaos, which is death. The oven becomes this symbolic space for transformation, for stabilizing the unmanageable.
Okay, that context helps understand the form of the ritual, but it doesn't lessen the danger of where Elsie took it, does it? Her system wasn't just commemorative, it became interactive, demanding.
Exactly. It became a closed loop. And closed loops fueled by obsession rarely end well. They tend to escalate until they consume the person running the system. Which brings us to the final devastating stages of this story.
Right, the escalation. The source describes this abrupt end to Elsie's isolation. The outside world finally intervenes. The neighbors broke in. That phrasing itself, broke in, suggests violence, a shattering of the boundaries she'd maintained.
It's the intrusion of the practical, the communal, into this intensely private hermetic system she'd built. And when they get inside, the scene they find, it reveals the true extent of the obsession.
What did they find?
The oven was still burning, the ritual clearly ongoing, but the sheer number of figures was overwhelming. Dozens lined up, some apparently perfectly formed, others half-baked. And then there are these disturbing details mentioned in some reports that some had teeth, some with tiny curls of hair.
Teeth? Hair? Oh, that's moved far beyond symbolic reasons for eyes. That's a terrifying level of detail, personalization.
It suggests a complete loss of boundary between the symbolic and the literal. The ritual wasn't just about memory anymore. It seems to have become this frantic, consuming mission to create more and more detailed, more real versions of these figures. The demand for realism, for interaction, escalated.
It sounds like the ritual itself took over, like she wasn't controlling it anymore. It was controlling her.
Precisely. This obsessive, accelerating pursuit, where the goal itself seems to recede even as the effort intensifies. This strongly echoes the callback for real-life Mario Marcobaloni in the Index.
Mario, how does he fit this picture of grief?
The Mario archetype analysis focuses on the idea that chasing the castle, the perpetual quest for the unattainable goal, whether it's rescuing the princess or, in Elsie's case, maybe achieving some perfect communion with a lost brother, fundamentally changes the player first. The pursuit itself consumes you. Elsie wasn't just grieving. She was locked in this relentless chase, this game against grief, and the game utterly transformed her, consumed her.
And the physical evidence of that consumption was right there on her, wasn't it? The description of Elsie herself in that scene.
Yes. The neighbors found her sitting quietly in a corner, and her hands were black with soot.
Soot. From the oven. From the ashes. She's literally covered in the materials of her ritual, the residue of her obsession.
It's the physical manifestation of her absorption into the system. The soot, the ashes, the very elements that began the tragedy and fueled the ritual now physically mark her. She's become one with the mechanism.
The system she built to contain her grief has trapped her instead, physically marked her.
It's a chilling illustration of the system turning on its creator. This connects directly to the Aladdin, Adil al-Din archetype. The core lesson there is that the treasure, the magic lamp, the powerful connection you seek, it often comes with rules that eventually bind you. The power becomes a prison.
The ritual connection was her treasure.
Exactly. And it became her trap. Elsie is the prisoner of her own self-made grief syndicate, isolated, marked by soot, utterly bound by the rules of the ritual she initiated.
And then there's the final image, the detail that just stops you cold and reframes everything.
The final detail reported from that scene. On the table, amidst the chaos, there was one more lump of dough waiting, ready to be shaped, ready for the oven.
But it wasn't for her brother this time.
No. The devastating shift, according to the source, is that this last lump was shaped specifically like a girl.
Oh, no. After all those years focused on him, she turned the ritual onto herself.
It seems so. Having perfected this mechanism for creating these figures, for containing presence through this ritual, she internalized it completely. That final figure suggests a move towards self-erasure, a desire to join the cycle, to become the next figure absorbed into the myth she'd painstakingly constructed.
So the ritual, the system, it didn't just consume her time and energy. It ultimately aimed to consume her.
It's the ultimate endpoint of the system training its user. The player becomes ready for integration. It perfectly illustrates that core theme running through the Inspector Index. When you create a system to contain something volatile, like memory or grief, You don't just control it, you risk becoming it. The system shapes you until you fit inside it.
What a devastating trajectory.
Yeah.
From a handful of ash to that, hashtag tag outro.
So when we pull back and look at both sources together, the intimate, horrifying story of the gingerbread ashes and the analytical framework of the Inspector Index, what's the connection?
It seems the connection is mechanism. The raw personal grief in Elsie's story, it followed certain steps, certain protocols. It escalated. It became a system.
Exactly. The gingerbread ashes gives us the visceral human reality of how these mechanisms can play out on the smallest, most personal scale. The Inspector Index gives us the language, the archetypes, to see the patterns in that unfolding tragedy, patterns of control, erasure, feedback loop, systemic traps that echo in much larger, more abstract systems.
So a deeply personal tragedy operated according to cold, systemic logic.
In a fundamental way, yes. The ritual, once set in motion, had its own momentum, its own rules that demanded adherence, just like any complex system.
It's chilling. We started with a remembrance, a story passed down, and traced it as it became this consuming legend. The ritual was meant to, I don't know, offer comfort, maybe?
Yeah.
To fix the memory somehow, like a recipe rising?
But instead, it became this relentless instrument of remembering that demanded more and more until it consumed the rememberer. The sources nail that tragic irony. Some recipes rise, hers remembered.
It makes you think about the systems we create in our own lives, maybe even unintentionally.
Absolutely. We often think of systems of control as these big external things, governments, corporations, technology. But this story shows how powerful, how consuming, a system built entirely within the walls of a single kitchen, fueled by grief and ritual, can become. The everyday, the domestic. It can hold these incredibly potent, sometimes terrifying, mechanisms.
So maybe the thought to leave you with is this. Consider the rituals in your own life. The things you do for comfort, for control, for remembrance. Are they serving you? Or are they maybe silently shaping you, trapping you, even erasing parts of your reality? What domestic objects around you hold memories hostage? Soot ring on a porcelain plate. Where the warmth left.